From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And it was predicted, but it has still been nerve-wracking waiting to learn who will be the next president of the United States. As mail-in vote counting continues in a number of key states, Wisconsin officials now say they are nearly finished counting ballots and that Joe Biden has a slim lead in that state of 20,000 votes. That's under 1%. It could qualify for a recount, which the Trump campaign says they will request.
And today, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who held on to his seat, open to more election litigation, telling reporters that going to court is, quote, the way we resolve uncertainty in our country, and that in close elections, you can anticipate will end up in court. Let's bring in Aisha Roscoe, NPR White House reporter. Hey, Aisha.
Hello.
Well, let's get to those comments from McConnell in just a moment. But first, officials in Pennsylvania has described counting there as smooth. What's the latest? What do we know about the voting counting in key swing states?
Well, it's ongoing. You know, the states are saying, states like Pennsylvania, they have been stressing that they are trying to make sure that they follow the law, that all the votes are counted, and that everything is done in a legal and transparent way. And so basically what, you know, the leaders in these states, including Nevada, Georgia, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan are saying is that they're trying to count all the votes and that it just takes time because there are a lot of mail-in votes.
Yeah. What is the White House saying about potential legal action going forward?
Well, President Trump yesterday, you know, said that he was ready to go to the Supreme Court to stop voting. Now, we should be clear, voting has stopped. What's happening now is just counting of votes that were already cast. But there isn't a clear path through which he could go straight to the Supreme Court. We do see that the campaign has said that they will likely demand a recount in Wisconsin. I should point out that the former Republican governor of Wisconsin, Scott Walker, who is, you know, a close ally of the White House, he said that 20,000 votes, if that holds up in Wisconsin, is a very high hurdle to overcome for Trump, even with a recount.
Yeah. You know, before yesterday, many experts predicted that the president would have an edge in terms of in-person voting on Election Day. But that you can count all in mail-in ballots. Those ballots would also boost Biden. But it isn't where we're seeing exactly what many had predicted.
Well, it is what people had predicted. But, you know, I think that people are still very much on edge because the country is very divided. But it was interesting because, you know, as we thought, in some of those southern states, you saw a bit of a blue mirage where they had counted early votes. Soon you saw Biden leading at first. But ultimately, when all those Election Day votes came in, President Trump won handily in Texas, in Florida, in Ohio is not a southern state, but in Ohio, it looked like Biden was leading at first. And then Trump pulled it out, you know, with by a large margin. And now you're kind of seeing the opposite of that happening in these Midwest states and some of these other states like Nevada, where, you know, President Trump looked like he was leading definitely in Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania with that Election Day vote. But now that they're counting those mail-in ballots, you're seeing Biden come up and start, you know, taking over the lead in some of those states. We have to wait till everything's counted, but you're seeing kind of the opposite.
Yeah. You laid this out just a bit, but can we talk about scenarios, pathways right now for Joe Biden to win and then for Trump possibly?
So Joe Biden right now, if he holds Nevada, which it has not been called yet, it's very close. If he holds Nevada, then he needs to win, you know, a combination of Michigan and, you know, in Wisconsin or Michigan and Pennsylvania, some combination of two of those three states to hold it. And that's, you know, if Georgia goes to Trump. And then for Trump, his path is a bit more narrow, especially after losing Arizona. He needs to hold, you know, flip more or hold on to that blue wall that he flipped in 2016 and, and definitely win Georgia. So those are some things that he has to try to do. But I should point out, it doesn't matter how narrow your path is. If you only need one path, right? Like if you make the path, you win. And so that's where we're at right now at this point, where there is some uncertainty about how things play out because all the votes have to be counted.
Ayesha Roscoe, NPR White House reporter, thank you so much for this update.
Thank you.
Let's pick up on some of the legal questions with Emily Bazelon, staff writer for the New York Times Magazine and a fellow at the Yale Law School. And Emily, I just want your thought when it was something like 2 a.m. when you heard President Trump say that he won the election and he wanted ballot counting stopped. He called it a fraud and said he planned to take the notion to the Supreme Court.
I mean, the first thing I thought was it's just an incredibly irresponsible move for a president to make when the counting is continuing, and he was confusing voting with counting and calling for stopping the vote, as Ayesha pointed out. And the second thing I thought is that it's really important to have a strong bipartisan rejection of anything that does not involve counting every ballot that should be counted. State and local officials have really made Herculean efforts to administer this election in the midst of a pandemic, and they need to be able to finish their work.
Well, and we heard from Chris Christie, a big Trump supporter at one time, and Marco Rubio saying, everything has to be counted. This is not fraud. So there's been some pushback there. But we've also seen Michigan's Secretary of State on television pleading with her constituents, letting them know that by law, she wasn't allowed to start counting the mail-in ballots till after polls closed. She'd asked Republican legislators to change the law. And they didn't. So there are laws in states that people are abiding by.
That's right. I mean, Republican legislators in Michigan and in Pennsylvania refused to make deals with Democrats that would have allowed for earlier counting. And so we're seeing something sort of ironic, which is that in Republican-led states, particularly Ohio and Florida, we had very early results because those states had weeks to process and tabulate their ballots. But the Republicans blocked exactly that path to an early complete count in Michigan and Pennsylvania. And that's part of why we have this few days of uncertainty.
Yeah. But what about the president's comment that he's going to take it right to the Supreme Court? It doesn't work that way, right? You have to go through the courts, or does it work that way?
It doesn't work that way. He would have to start in a federal district court like every other lawsuit. But I think what he meant was that he was going to try to bring federal cases or state law cases that challenge counting, challenge the validity of ballots where he can do that, and that perhaps eventually one of those cases would make it to the Supreme Court. I don't see out there a big wholesale Republican effort to stop the counting. So I think what we're more talking about is whether enough states that could make a difference to the Electoral College margin of victory are within the very close percentages that call for a recount. And that depends on every state law. Every state has its own rules about recounts. And so we may be hearing a lot about those details, or we may be hearing nothing about it at all, because it will turn out that there are enough states that break for Joe Biden in this remaining group that it is just out of President Trump's reach.
But again, if there aren't, I've had a lot of listeners ask me to ask you, can Attorney General William Barr intercede in any way in this? He has said publicly that he thinks mail ballot voting does lead to fraud. We know historically it hasn't, but can he do anything?
I mean, it would be so incredibly irregular for the Justice Department to try to stop these valid counts that are going on. What the states are doing is their normal process. And this is where it's actually helpful that we have a division of power in the United States between the federal government and state and local governments. These rules are state law rules. The people who are actually conducting this count, they are state and local officials, and William Barr doesn't control them. So it just is really hard for me to imagine how the Justice Department can prevent this count from going forward.
Yeah. So since we have you, Emily, and your thing is the Supreme Court, we've got about a minute here. I want to make sure we've asked you. The court, with Amy Coney Barrett on the bench, heard oral arguments today in a case that pits the rights of a city, in this case Philadelphia, to enforce its anti-discrimination policies against the rights of religious groups. And this involves the rights of LGBTQ people. Just briefly explain.
Yeah, this is a very highly contested lawsuit between the city of Philadelphia, which has a contract with private foster care agencies. And as part of that contract, you're not allowed to discriminate against LGBTQ couples. The Catholic social services in the city challenged that that rule because they say that not discriminating against LGBTQ people violate their constitutional rights to freedom of religion. And what we saw today were the new conservative majority very sympathetic to Catholic social services, even though ruling for them would require a major change in the law.
No, I mean, Emily Bazelon, staff writer for the New York Times Magazine, a fellow at the Yale Law School. We're going to continue to follow that Supreme Court case, as well as this post-election coverage. And by the way, we direct you to Nina Totenberg's reporting on this as well. You'll find it at NPR. But Emily, thank you so much for weighing in. I think, you know, the way this day is going, we'll probably reach out again. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
As we've been reporting, early this morning, President Trump falsely declared victory, asked for all voting to be stopped, said the ongoing counting of mail-in ballots was fraud. Of course, the counting of mail-in ballots is always done no matter how long it takes. The Biden campaign promptly said so. But what's happened since? Let's check in on the thinking in the campaigns.
Yeah, NPR national correspondent Asma Khalid joins us. She's been covering the Biden campaign. And also here is NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez. He's been following the Trump campaign. And let's start with you, Franco. What is the White House and the campaign saying about President Trump's assertion both today and last night? He's first alleging the counts that are happening today are in favor of Biden, and that's voter fraud. And he falsely declared victory last night and is asking for the vote counting to stop. Are they standing behind that?
Well, I mean, the president certainly is not backing down. He tweeted this morning about his lead, quote, magically disappearing and how strange it was. He said people are, quote, working hard to undercut his advantages that he have in Pennsylvania and Michigan. And, you know, the campaign is not undercutting that, but they're saying that they will win if legally cast ballots are counted and not illegally cast ballots. But they're not specifying what is illegal and what is legal.
Yeah. Republican analyst Chris Christie called it a bad strategic and political decision for the president to say what he did last night. And Rick Santorum said he was distressed by Trump's words. But no Republican elected official has publicly criticized Trump for those remarks. Are there signs that Republicans are trying to shift the messaging?
Yeah, I mean, I've heard from some of those Republicans as well. And, you know, I can say that certainly the focus of the talks that we've had with the campaign have not centered on that. They did not make accusations about fraud in Pennsylvania or Michigan. They just said that the pollsters were wrong and that they were not taking into account rural communities that were full of Trump supporters and, you know, kind of putting them into the count of the others.
Yeah. Well, Asma, I want to ask you to come in here covering the Biden campaign as you are. What a day it's been. And, it was predicted that the early voting would go to Donald Trump because this was mostly walk-in. And then the mail-in ballots would more likely tilt towards the Biden campaign. You know, they're now saying they see a path to victory. It wasn't, you know, this morning it was much tighter. What's going on there?
Yeah, you know, we heard from the Biden campaign earlier this morning, and Biden's campaign manager, Jen O'Malley Dillon, said that she feels the former vice president is on track to win this election. They feel confident, and the lead that they've seen now, both in Wisconsin and Michigan, support that theory. Of course, Wisconsin is still incredibly close, and as we know, it sounds like the Trump campaign is wanting a recount there. But look, they have said that they feel like the early vote, the ballots were going to favor former Vice President Joe Biden. And in fact, this was part of the Democratic strategy for a while to encourage people to vote early or to vote by mail. And that's what we've seen so far. But they're also trying to encourage patience. They say that this process and making sure every ballot is counted could take a while.
Yeah, well, I want to ask you both, and maybe just start with Asma and then Franco, you just pick up. But these paths to victory that the candidates had, you know, through states like, as you said, Nevada, Arizona, Michigan, Wisconsin for Biden, for Trump, Georgia, Pennsylvania, Alaska, perhaps, you know, that's kind of been the map all morning. But what was the biggest shock? You know, Asma, start with you. What did a campaign really expect that didn't happen?
Well, I think that they were projecting a really bullish sort of image. If I were to say even yesterday, early morning or the day before, you know, I mentioned to a couple of our editors that I felt like for much of this season, the Biden campaign had been fairly cautious, you know, wary of repeating some of that overly optimistic attitude that Democrats had during the 2016 election. But in the last sort of 48 hours, it felt like they were really rosy about their chances. We had seen Democrats campaigning in traditionally Republican states like Georgia and Texas. And there was a thought that this could be really a mandate for Joe Biden. To me, one of the clearest takeaways of last night and into this morning is that this is not a mandate for either candidate. It is an incredibly tight election. Mm-hmm. We see in some House races that Democrats actually lost some House seats. They don't seem to have picked up all the Senate seats that they expected.
Yeah, you know, it's probably way too early to ask these questions because we're all looking to find out who is the ultimate winner. But Asma, you know, are they acknowledging their weaknesses? Biden, primarily among Cuban-American voters in Miami, where his campaign started door knocking very late. Or was it just that he knew he needed to focus on remaking the blue wall in the Midwest? And I think we might have some...
By the fact that I actually don't seem to be...
And it feels like we may be having some problems with Asma's line. But Franco, you know, when I'm thinking about Trump's weaknesses, Trump spoke to many times during his campaign directly to this population of suburban women, which, to be clear, we're talking about white suburban women. Did Trump show weaknesses among these voters and in his own base, which is often described as white blue collar men? I mean, Biden had fewer votes in Youngstown, Ohio, for instance, than Clinton did. So maybe not.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly those aspects there. I mean, what one of the things, like, you know, just to pick up on where Asma left off is, excuse me, is, you know, kind of like this outcome with Florida. You know, there was a lot of weakness with seniors, for example, and there was a lot of concerns that, you know, seniors' dissatisfaction with how the president was handling the pandemic. You know, 230,000 Americans had died from this pandemic, and that was seen as one of those very big weaknesses. But, you know, in Florida, President Trump won Florida, and he won it, you know, because he kind of built some strength with another group that was not expected, which were Latinos. You mentioned the Cuban Americans. There's also the Venezuelan Americans, because President Trump's message against socialism really resonated with him. To me, that was so fascinating because it really set off kind of like this wave of enthusiasm temporarily in the Trump campaign. And I had people texting me that it was like deja vu from 2016.
Asma, I want to bring you back in here. You're back, and we were talking a little bit about the weaknesses of Biden and maybe the focus on remaking the blue wall in the Midwest.
Yeah, you know, I think that certainly that is part of the focus. You know, I was struck, though, if you look at some of those so-called Obama-Trump counties, these are pivot counties all across the Midwest. You know, my colleague Danielle Kurtzleben and I were looking at some of them in both Iowa and Ohio. These were kind of reach states for Democrats. But one thing that I was struck with was the fact that some of those pivot counties that went for President Trump in 2016 actually looked just as red, if not redder, last night than they did 4 years ago. So, you know, there was a lot of talk from Democrats that Biden, they thought, was the candidate who could perhaps appeal to white working class voters and win some of those folks back. It doesn't seem like that, you know, sort of a broad brushstroke seems to be true. But I do really want to echo also what Franco was saying about, you know, Florida. I mean, Florida to me is kind of the really wildest story of the night, in part because the Miami-Dade margin is just astounding. I mean, Hillary Clinton won Miami-Dade by roughly 30 points in 2016, even though she lost the state. President Trump was able to shrink that margin to single digits. I believe that in the end of the night, it was like 7 or 8 points. I mean, that's just a huge, huge difference. And even though Joe Biden did better in other parts of the state of Florida, you can't really compensate for that when you're talking about the biggest county in the entire state of Florida.
And Asma, I just want to ask, do you think that was because Trump successfully pinned the title of socialist on Biden?
You know what? Look, I think that's part of it. But I was also texting with a former Biden campaign staffer. She hasn't worked for them for quite a while, but she was a fairly, you know, senior Latina in the campaign. And you know, she acknowledged that she felt like the campaign could have been doing more work in Florida earlier. And there are Latino activists this morning who feel, you know, critical of what the Biden campaign did in terms of investment broadly within the Latino community. And these are not new concerns, Robin. I mean, I felt like I kept hearing them throughout the campaign cycle. Of course, the Latino community is not a monolith. And we see in Arizona, for example, Joe Biden did do well. But in Florida in particular, I kept hearing concerns from people. They wanted more investment from the Biden campaign. So I was struck this morning to hear Biden's campaign manager refer to the fact that they thought, you know, that this was not an underperforming by Joe Biden. It was just that Trump increased his support with Cuban Americans, because I think both of those statements are true. Biden didn't do as well as some Democrats had hoped he would.
Right. And Franco, I just want to ask you, in the minute we have left, what was the role of the coronavirus?
Well, the role of the coronavirus was, you know, was huge. I mean, that is basically what, you know, Joe Biden was able to put President Trump on the defensive about. I mean, it was the central part of his campaign. And it was, you know, such an issue for President Trump for months, you know, since the summer. President Trump has been trying to change the focus of his campaign away from the coronavirus, trying to focus on normalizing, trying to get things back to normal. And like he began, he ended, you know, continuing to downplay the significance of the virus, trying to tell people that, you know, on November 4th that, you know, all the coronavirus would be gone, you know, businesses would open, you know, states would open. It's November 4th right now, by the way. You know, we have a surging pandemic right now, and cases are on the rise, hospitalizations are on the rise, and it was something that President Trump could not escape no matter how hard he tried.
That's NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez and NPR national political correspondent Asma Khalid. Thank you to both.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Election day has come and gone and left several battleground states still too close to call in its wake. In Pennsylvania, officials say it could be several days before we know a clear winner for president. The same is true in Michigan. In Georgia, the presidential race and the state's two Senate races are somewhat up in the air. Emma Hurt is a reporter for member station WABE. She joins us from Atlanta. And Emma, we know that Georgia was supposed to be one of the stepping stones on, you know, President Trump's narrow path to victory. At the moment, he is leading. But just talk about the votes. How many in? How many anticipated? What's going on?
Yeah, so right now we're looking at about an 84,000 vote difference between Vice President Biden and President Trump, who, as you said, is in the lead. And as of this morning, the Secretary of State said about 200,000 absentee ballots are still outstanding. With what we've seen since then, roughly 170 to 180,000 seem to be left. And many of those are in Metro Atlanta, which is a reliably Democratic stronghold. Not all of them, though. So everyone is still holding their breath.
Well, as they are about your Senate races, I want to make sure we've talked about this. Why are these particularly important, both races?
Yeah, so I guess it's important because we have two, right? And also that one of them is definitely going into a runoff. So we know that we have incumbent Republican Kelly Loeffler in a runoff with Democratic frontrunner and now candidate nominee Raphael Warnock, the pastor of Martin Luther King Jr.'s home church in Atlanta. So that's set for January. And then the other race is still up in the air, too close to call. And if neither candidate wins more than 50% of the vote, that race could also end up in a January runoff. And since Democrats, you know, have not made the gains that they thought they would or had hoped to in the Senate, there's a chance that all that energy and attention could come pouring in here in the next couple weeks.
And remind us who's in that race.
Yes. Forgive me. Senator David Perdue is the Republican incumbent there. He's a close Trump ally. And his challenger is Democrat John Ossoff, who caught national attention for trying to flip a suburban congressional seat in 2017, didn't make it, and he's back for more.
Yeah. I'm amazed that any of you reporters are upright at this point after the nights that you've been going through. But just in the minute we have, the competitive congressional races in Metro Atlanta, tell us about that.
Yeah, so there are two races in Metro Atlanta that have been closely watched. The six congressional district Democrats flipped in 2018, and they have held on to that seat. So that is something to note. And then the seventh district was the closest congressional race in the country in 2018. And the Democrat who nearly flipped it then is leading right now. The AP has not called the race. She has claimed victory and she is ahead, but it's looking good for her. But again, jury is very much still out.
Right. And again, it's thought that President Trump needs Georgia, Pennsylvania, Alaska to win. What's the mood there? Real brief.
Yeah, I mean, I really think it's holding breath. You know, I've got people texting me all day long. Do you know how many votes are left? How many votes? What's going on? And everyone's kind of afraid to make any sort of statement about what's going to happen.
Yeah. People, Emma Hurd is not counting the votes. She's a reporter for member station WABE in Atlanta. Emma, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
There's a lot we still don't know about yesterday's election, but among the things we do know, it was a big night for marijuana. And of course, by that I mean four more states voted to legalize recreational marijuana. Uber and other gig economy businesses in California will not have to classify their drivers as employees, leaving Uber and other gig companies off the hook when it comes to benefits. And the minimum wage is going up to $15 an hour in Florida. These decisions were among the more than 100 ballot measures across 32 states yesterday. Let's bring in Josh Altick. He's project director at Ballotpedia in Wisconsin. He's been following this. So, Josh, we're going to get to all 100. No, we're not. We're going to get to as many as we can. But start with California's Prop 22. It's being called the most expensive ballot initiative in state history. It asked whether gig economy companies had to classify their workers as employees. Now, the decision that they don't sent shares of Uber and Lyft soaring. But what does this mean for people employed in the gig economy?
Yeah, one of the most interesting measures we're watching this year, and super expensive, broke all kinds of records. So it specifically concerns app-based drivers. And it's a response to AB 5 passed in 2019 that defines independent contractors in a way that makes these employees classify their workers as actual employees. That means minimum wage, certain benefit requirements, et cetera. So this was definitely a best defense is a good offense action by Uber, Lyft, DoorDash, and their cohorts. And they were willing to spend over $200 million to get the measure passed. The significance is immense. So one thing to note is the measure, it allows the workers to remain as independent contractors, but it also gives some other restrictions. Like there is a wage floor in the measure, some like worker training requirements and health insurance requirements. So there were other factors in play as well. But this is one that, you know, this policy is new. It's the first time voters have decided a gig economy on the ballot. And we'll see sort of whether other states consider this policy in the future.
Yeah. As we said, marijuana won in several states, in Arizona, Montana, New Jersey, and South Dakota. Voters voted to legalize marijuana for recreational use. There was also medical marijuana on the ballot elsewhere. Oregon voted to legalize psychedelic mushrooms. Look, take that first. It doesn't mean that people can just wander into the street and take some psychedelic mushrooms. What does it mean?
Yeah, the Oregon measure, Measure 109, was, from the perspective of mushroom advocates, kind of conservative. So basically, it allows psilocybin services, which means, by the initiative's language, that there will be certain centers with trained administrators, and you would go for a session that under observation by an administrator. So that's what it allows for anyone 21 and over. But there was another measure paired with that one, Measure 110, that was also on the ballot, and that actually was sort of a first of its kind as well. It decriminalized all Schedule 1 through 4 drugs. It made them just a violation with a $100 maximum fine. So those two in combination give an interesting take on sort of what the direction of that particular policy is going, as well as the D.C. measure, which also passed.
Yeah, the D.C. measure also decriminalized mushrooms.
Right. Mushrooms and any other entheogenic fungi. That's what how they described it. That includes Ibega and other things, but a big focus on psilocybin.
Okay. In Florida, voters chose President Trump over Joe Biden, as we've been saying, but also overwhelmingly approved increasing the minimum wage to $15 an hour by 2026. What do you think that is? What happened there?
Yeah. So minimum wage is always a very popular position, is increasing the minimum wage. There's been 26 measures since, I think, 1996, and all but two have passed, and those two were a long time ago. So this measure, I think the AP's called it, and most people have called it, but it is actually still very close, because it required a 60% supermajority requirement to pass, and it's sitting right about 60.8, so very close. But I think the main takeaway is this is actually the first time statewide voters have decided on that magic number, 15, which has been kind of a focal point of the minimum wage movement for a while. So what the measure would do is increase the minimum wage by $1 per year until it gets to $15 per hour by 2026. And it's the first time that that $15 per hour number has been on the ballot. And it, like you said, it has got, you know, 60% approval, which it needs. Interesting first.
Yeah, and we are taking a look at ballot questions. If you've just tuned in with Josh Altick of Ballotpedia, we're also keeping an eye on all the news of the day. If any state suddenly counts all its ballots or anything changes, we'll bring that to you. But one of the reasons to look at ballot measures and what happened is that it usually does go, it spreads from state to state. So let's look at Illinois, where a ballot measure there that was trying to change the state's income tax from a flat rate to a graduated rate. This was supported by Democratic Governor J.B. Pritzker. He campaigned on changing the way taxes are collected. Remind us briefly what that means, the proposal, and then what happened.
Sure. So the proposal is to allow the legislature to tax higher incomes at higher levels, as opposed to the current requirement in the Constitution that there's one flat rate for all levels of income. And I think what sticks out to this one is not only that it failed, because it was a little close going in, but that it failed by such a large margin. I know 5 points doesn't seem large, but this measure required either a 60% majority or a majority from all ballots cast at the election. So this needed a bit of a cushion, and it got the opposite of that. And I think the biggest factor is just you look at the spending. Neck and neck going into the election at little over 60 million both on the support side and 60 million on the opposition side. And it was kind of a shootout between Governor Pritzker and Ken Griffin, who's the founder and CEO of Citadel. So I think that spending on the opposition side really tipped the scale. And I think some people are a little surprised by the final margins there.
Yeah. In Colorado, a ballot measure that would have banned abortions at 22 weeks or later failed. This was the fourth attempt since 2008 to restrict abortion rights in that state. Just briefly on that.
Sure. I mean, this is a new effort. They've gone really big and really small before. They've tried to ban partial birth abortions, which barely failed. And they've tried to define, kind of do a personhood measure, which failed handily. This one was supposed to be kind of a middle of the road measure. And I think some people are going to be surprised by how much it failed by. And that could speak to maybe the climate of the country right now and possibly Supreme Court interests and concerns and what's going on there. The measure failed. And one thing to point out is there was one other abortion measure on the ballot in Louisiana. And that just stated that nothing in the Constitution secures or protects the right to abortion. And that measure passed. So two interesting things there.
Yeah, especially since the Roe v. Wade questions are headed to, you know, possibly headed to the Supreme Court. Redistricting measures were on the ballot in three states. Let's talk about Virginia. It called for a constitutional amendment to create a bipartisan redistricting commission. This is years after huge battles over gerrymandering, you know, carving out districts to benefit certain parties. What did voters say?
Voters liked this one, 65% and counting in favor of it, which was kind of an interesting saga that played out because it requires two sessions to put a measure on the ballot. And there was a really strong bipartisan support at first. And then I think some Democrats had some buyer's remorse when they took control of the House. There was actually some Democrats who were opposed to this going into the election. But the measure was already on the ballot, and the voters said, yes, please.
Okay, we only got about a minute left. So this is your choice. It's just something that struck you.
Sure. Let's go back to marijuana. I think everyone's used to seeing it. It might seem boring, but the new things this year, three states, Montana, South Dakota, and Arizona, those are the first three states to vote on marijuana and pass it that voted Republican in the presidential elections from 2000 to 2016. So, I mean, Arizona flipped this year, but strong are states that voted in favor of marijuana. I think that's what's new this year in the marijuana movement, and it's kind of just continued momentum for that movement after 9 states have already approved it through ballot initiatives and 2 states through legislative action.
And again, if someone just tuned in and heard you say, let's go back to marijuana, we are talking about ballot questions. There are over 100. We direct you to Ballotpedia because they'll go through all of them for you. Here in Massachusetts, voters reject ranked voting. That's where somebody who doesn't come in first might actually win a race. That was rejected. So many out there. They're actually fun to read. Josh Altick from Ballotpedia, thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Thanks for having me on, Robin.
President Trump's campaign manager says they will request a recount in Wisconsin, where Biden currently leads by less than a percentage point. And votes are still being counted in other key states, including Nevada, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. Let's take a closer look at what we know so far with Ron Elving, NPR senior editor and correspondent. And Ron, the race remains very close still. What's the latest in some of those key states?
Very close indeed. There are 7 states that are not conceded, that are still open in some sense or another. 4 in the Sun Belt, that would be North Carolina, Georgia, Arizona, and Nevada. Now, most folks think that Arizona is done. The AP has called it, NPR has called it, but the Trump administration is disputing it, and Republicans in general are. In Nevada, there's about a 7,000 vote lead for Joe Biden. But that's not very much, and they're not going to tell us what happened with their absentee ballots until tomorrow. So that could be open for at least another 24 hours. Then up in the Great Lakes area, you have the 3 that people have been paying attention to all year. And they were very close in 2016, and they're very close again. So in Wisconsin, it appears that Biden is ahead by about 20,000 votes, with all the votes or virtually all the votes counted. So we may get a recount there, but for now, it looks like Biden. In Michigan, it's about a 50,000 vote margin, but growing as they count more ballots that were mailed in from the Detroit area. And in Pennsylvania, the Trump lead is really quite large there. It's hundreds of thousands of votes, but you've got well over 1 million votes yet to count, and those mailed-in ballots are breaking strongly for Biden, so that one's not for sure yet either. Neither is Georgia back down in the Sun Belt, where they're still counting votes from around the Atlanta metro.
Yeah, we're still counting all of those mail-in ballot votes and early votes. What are the campaigns saying about their paths to victory at this point?
Interesting that both campaigns basically are laying some sort of claim to all 7 of those states that I just mentioned. I think the one that people are most focused on insisting is theirs is Pennsylvania, because that really would be necessary for Trump to put together the votes that he would need to get to 270. There is a path for Biden to get there without Pennsylvania if he gets Arizona, Nevada, and both Wisconsin and Michigan. He does have leads in those 4 states, though, so it's conceivable that he could win the presidency with the bare minimum of 270 electoral votes without Pennsylvania. But that's really the one that both campaigns are focusing on the most. And as I say, both campaigns are still insisting that they're in the ballgame in all 7.
Ron, can we talk a little bit about the close nature of these exit polls, especially in places that were once Republican strongholds? I mean, is this evidence that Democrats are continuing to make inroads with some populations within the suburbs and rural voters? And will it be enough for them to win in some of these states?
There are really mixed indications on that particular question, because in some states, such as Georgia, you saw real Democratic improvement of the state becoming more competitive. But it was a disappointment to Democrats in Florida and in Texas, where they really expected to do better in the suburbs than they wound up doing. And so as a result, they lost some House races, U.S. Congress races, that they expected to win in Florida and in Texas, where they hoped to win. In Texas, they hoped to flip the state House in the state legislature, and that didn't happen. And it was disappointment, really, in terms of that suburban vote. We saw better results for the Democrats in the suburbs in Arizona. But really very little change in some other parts of the country. The Democrats had really hoped they could penetrate. Ohio is another one that wound up looking very much like it did in 2016.
Do you think we'll be having deeper conversations on why the polls got it so wrong in some of these places? Your thoughts on this?
they were terribly wrong in some places. Not so much the polls that were done within a state. For example, in Iowa, the Iowa poll was dead on, or actually it kind of understated President Trump's margin there, which wound up looking a lot like 2016 again. But there were a lot of other polls that thought Iowa was going to go for Biden. There were polls that thought it was going to be a double-digit blowout for Biden in Wisconsin, and we're down to one percentage point instead. Ditto in Michigan, probably also in Pennsylvania, although that was closer. So the pollsters really repeated the wide gap between the expectations that they set up with their work and what actually happened. No one thought that that could be quite that bad again, but it pretty much was in some of these states that I just mentioned.
You know, it also appears that Trump improved on his popular vote count, although he does appear at this moment to be on track to lose the popular vote again. Based on the results we have so far, does it appear the president has actually expanded his base since 2016?
Not really. I wouldn't say he had expanded his base, but what they did do is they managed to find more people who fit in with the president's base. That is, people who were much like his voters of 2016, but had not actually gone to the polls in 2016, possibly because they didn't think he had a chance. But they were very good. The Republicans were very good at finding and organizing those people in Pennsylvania and in Florida and in Wisconsin. And they have shown that they can do that pretty much anywhere in the country up to a point. And as a result, they were able to improve on his actual numbers and perhaps a little bit on his percentage of the vote, although Biden is clearly going to get more than half. He's going to have 51, maybe 52% of the national popular vote and win by several million votes. But at the same time, as we know, that doesn't really matter.
Right. So much to follow here. That's NPR senior editor and correspondent Ron Elving. As always, thank you.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.